This summer, we have been studying the role that philosophy has played in the articulation of the church's theology. Philosophy, in many ways, has provided the specific categories of thinking that have enabled the church's theologians to explain God's revelation. I want you to keep in mind that we are not saying in this study that the church has taken pagan philosophy and put a Christian face on it. Rather, philosophy has been a tool that has enabled the church to better explain God's revelation in the scriptures, particularly to pagans. And some Christians, such as Justin Martyr, did teach that there was a certain amount of truth in philosophy, but only because it was consistent with God's revelation. It was first and foremost believed in the scriptures, and therefore it was true. But when we come to the gentleman known as Thomas Aquinas and his teaching, the relationship between philosophy and theology changes significantly. Using the teachings of Aristotle chiefly, Aquinas distinguished between that which could be known about God through philosophy and that which could be known about God through the scriptures. And although philosophy could only take a person so far in revealing truth about God, it could reveal truth nonetheless. The revelation, or this revelation of God through philosophy, has come to be known as natural theology. And it is that natural theology that we are going to discuss tonight, specifically Thomas Aquinas's natural theology. Now we're going to follow the following train of thought, the roadmap to get us to this goal. I want us to look at three different things. First, we need to look at the life and the times of Thomas Aquinas. Who was this man, Aquinas? And what do we know about the age and the times in which he lived? Give us a little context for the discussion. The life and times of Thomas Aquinas. Secondly, I want us to look at the prominence of Aristotelian philosophy. The prominence of Aristotelian philosophy. Chiefly, these sections, these lectures have dealt with Platonic philosophy. That's really been in the forefront. We had one discussion of Aristotle, but Plato has dominated the discussion. Well, now things are going to turn. Now Aristotle is going to come to prominence. And then thirdly, we'll conclude our discussion by looking at the synthesis of philosophy and theology in the teaching of Thomas Aquinas. How did philosophy and theology come together with this man Aquinas? We're going to look at their synthesis in his teaching. So let's begin then with the discussion of the life and times of Thomas Aquinas. And in your mind, let us go back to the medieval period, as they've been come to know today, the Middle Ages, and particularly the 13th century. In the 13th century, a new type of theological teacher arose. History has labeled this teacher as a schoolman or a scholastic. Now, a scholastic was a master of learning whose trade was teaching in the classroom. We have tradesmen in this church. We have one with us tonight, Mr. Chip, who is a master cabinet maker or door maker. He's a master of all things dealing with carpentry. He understands the topic, and he spends his days doing that trade. Well, now in the Middle Ages, as you had all those particular trades, now we're going to have a new trade, a master of learning whose trade is teaching, particularly in the classroom. And scholasticism is the method of theology that is associated with these schoolmen, and it's best described as a way of organizing theology. It's not so much its content as it is a method. It's a highly developed method of presenting material, making fine distinctions, and attempting to achieve a comprehensive view of theology. It emphasized the rational justification of religious belief and then the systematic presentation of those beliefs. Now, how did this new trade and this new method arise? Well, for centuries, learning had taken place primarily in the monasteries. But in the 12th century, cathedral schools became the center of theological activity. Cathedral schools, by the way, were connected with churches that had bishops in them, bishops who were in charge of a group of churches in a given area, and thus these cathedral schools were usually in cities. Hey, but no sooner had the cathedral cities or the cathedral schools achieved prominence when they were actually supplanted by universities, where vast associations of scholars or schoolmen gathered in the principal cities. So here's what I'm saying. City growth thus played an important role in the development of scholasticism. As students gathered in urban centers, again, first at these cathedral schools, but then other schools, these schools were then gathered together and united in what came to be known as general studies. And out of these general studies evolved the main universities of Europe. Basically, these universities were guilds of scholars, both teachers and students, which organized in order to defend the rights of their members and to certify the level of proficiency achieved by each. So you could think of that in the sense of like a modern union. They gathered together to protect each other's rights. Or perhaps under the context of a modern accrediting board. They wanted to make sure that those who were teaching and learning were actually doing it according to certain standards. So they banded together in the cities, and thus you had these universities. Now, as the universities grew, some soon became famous in a particular field of study. And for theological studies, the main universities were Paris and Oxford. Those who aspired to become theologians first spent, listen to this curriculum, first spent several years studying philosophy and humanities in the arts faculty. At that point, when they completed that, they then entered the faculty of theology, where they began as hearers and could progressively become biblical bachelors, bachelors on the sentences, formed bachelors, licensed masters, and finally, doctors. And by the 14th century, this process required 14 years after having completed one's studies in the arts faculty. Beth, you thought we had it bad. You think some of our men are in school a long time today. This is after you get the foundational training, 14 more years of theological education. Now, during the medieval period, these doctors and other theologians developed this method of doing theology that I have already defined as scholasticism. Now, Thomas Aquinas, he is the particular scholastic with whom we are concerned tonight. Aquinas was born in 1224, spent most of his life in academic circles, and became a famous professor at the University of Paris. As a young man, he was actually very quiet. He was also quite large, and thus he earned the nickname the Dumb Ox. But as he grew, despite the fact that he was so quiet, people began to notice his intelligence. And even to the point that one of his teachers said, well, when this ox bellows, it's going to be heard all around the world. He was a genius, had a great intellect. His literary productions were enormous. He eventually became, I said, he spent most of his life in academic circles, and he became a famous professor at the University of Paris. His two main works are the Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologica. Two well-known works. They're on lists of great books. And he died in 1274. Notice when he was just scarcely 50 years old. Now, it is impossible to even begin to survey Aquinas' theological system in the time that we have tonight. And therefore, we must content ourselves with a survey of his five ways to prove the existence of God, his five ways by which he sought to prove God's existence. That will actually be our main topic. But right before we get to the five ways, we need to first discuss the influence of Aristotelian philosophy on Aquinas' theology. And thus we come now to our second point, which is the prominence of Aristotelian philosophy. What I need to do here is lay out for you, both generally and even perhaps a little specifically, what it was about Aristotle that influenced the theologians, particularly Aquinas. So that then when we get to the third point and look at Aquinas' natural theology and his five ways, you begin to connect the dots in your mind. Draw the lines from the third point back to the second point, from Aquinas' theology to Aristotle's philosophy, and you'll begin to see the influence there. I'll point out some of it for you. But if you see what we're laying out in the second point, you'll be able to connect the dots yourself. So notice, secondly, then, the prominence of Aristotelian philosophy. One of the consequences of the Crusades, whereby Christianity sought to carve out a Christian empire in the East, so I should say Western Christianity sought to carve out for itself a Christian empire in the East. And by the way, let me pause real quick and say this. We're very used to looking poorly on the Crusades, and I'm not about to make any great defense for them. But let us not be too hard on the people and the times in which those Crusaders lived. There were no people, Christians then, who objected to this as if it was some great inhumane thing. That's very anachronistic for us to speak of anybody back then who would be so supposed. That was the general thinking of Christians, that we should take the Eastern Empire for Christianity and consolidate the church. Remember, there was a great schism in 1054. One of the goals of the Crusades was to bring the Eastern Church back under the control of the West. So though I see great abuses in the Crusades, and today we can look at their failures and their atrocities, we must also remember the people then were people of their times. They can only be judged by what they knew. But one of the consequences of the Crusades was the introduction of Aristotelian philosophy into Western thought. As the Crusaders returned from the East and destinations such as Constantinople, they brought many of the treasures of the East, including the writings of Aristotle, with them. And although Aristotle had many critics, he also soon had many adherents and was able to assume a level of preeminence in the university system. In fact, by the year 1255, the Faculty of Arts at the University of Paris adopted a new syllabus that imposed the study of all known works of Aristotle on its students. That's the foundational level at Paris, the Faculty of Arts. And the new syllabus was this: you are to study every known work of Aristotle. And by about 1270, he had been established as the philosopher. So he had really come to prominence. Now, why is this? Well, one of the reasons is that Aristotle's spirit of curiosity and his criticisms of others' views matched the schoolmen's growing curiosity and confidence. That is, they liked his attitude. I mean, here were men who are ready to study everything and to be exhaustive and to make fine distinctions and come to great systematizations and summary. Aristotle had a similar spirit. He was curious about everything. He was always looking into things, and he wasn't slow to criticize the view of others. They liked that attitude, and they emulated it. So with Aristotle's works as the basis of instruction in the arts faculty at the University of Paris, soon sharp distinctions between faith and reason, between natural and supernatural, between philosophy and theology, distinctions that had never existed in Christianity, soon they began to develop. Now, what is it about Aristotle's philosophy that caused these distinctions? Well, think about it like this. Aristotle, he was one of actually the greatest biologists of all time. And he had, as you may remember from a few weeks back, a world-centered philosophy. That is, he focused on this world in all that we can see and study. And his achievements were so great, and they were achieved without divine revelation and grace. That is, he was not a Christian who studied the Bible. His achievements were so great that therefore a place had to be made for human knowledge. That is, if Aristotle was able to figure out so much on his own, then humans must be able to discover certain truths without the aid of divine revelation. That is, without the aid of the scriptures. Thus, a place was made for human knowledge. and the implications of that human knowledge for theology. And so you have these distinctions now between nature and grace, faith and reason, philosophy and theology. Maybe one of the ways to help understand this is think about somebody today in our world who does not profess to be a Christian, but is perhaps a great philanthropist, a very moral, a very kind, very giving. And we look at them and we say, okay, wait a minute. I know all men are lost in sin and depraved and guilty. How in the world do you have a person who's so moral and giving yet lost? Well, some people are tempted to perhaps change their views on depravity and make way for freedom of the will and certain morals which are able to proceed for men who are dead in sin. By the way, it was the Protestant Reformation that made an attempt to escape from these distinctions, particularly by their re-emphasis on man's depravity. And that's the platform from which I just made those statements. But you have now these distinctions between faith and reason. Now, that's the general influence. The specific influence, the Aristotelian philosophy that primarily influenced Aquinas' theology, was expressed in Aristotle's Metaphysics, being just a study of beyond physics, reality and such. In this work, Aristotle says this. He says that philosophy is primarily a study of being, of reality, and of existence. And in his work, Aristotle argues that those substances which are free of change are pure actualities. Here's what I mean by that. They, those things which do not change, they are the most completely real things that are. That which does not change is that which is truly real. So therefore, philosophy concentrates on studying being and existence in its most perfect form. That is, that which does not change. Here's where Aristotle went with that. He says that study will culminate in a knowledge of the attributes of, listen to this, of the first unmoved mover. Studying existence as it really is, and that which does not change, will culminate in a knowledge of the first unmoved mover. By the way, Aristotle called that particular study theology. Now, what Aquinas is going to do is he is going to both use this concept of the first unmoved mover, and he's going to go beyond it. So here's just what I'm driving at in the second point as I bring it to a summary. Aristotle influenced Aquinas in two ways. Generally, he created these distinctions between faith and reason and the need to make a place for philosophy within theology. That was the general influence. And then specifically, Aristotle's conception of metaphysics, which culminates in knowledge of the first unmoved mover. That's some specific thought that drove Aquinas' system. So now, to answer the question that we've been setting up thus far tonight, how did this philosophy and theology come to a synthesis in the teaching of Thomas Aquinas? Our third point, and thus we seek to answer and demonstrate that synthesis. Now, Aquinas used Aristotle's metaphysical theology to both understand theology, that's what we've been studying all summer, and also give theology a new direction by means of what I've already called natural theology. What this means is that Aquinas made room for philosophy within the subject matter of theology itself. He brought philosophy into the subject matter of theology. Now, how did Aquinas do that? Well, here's the key idea of natural theology. Aquinas argues that God has revealed strictly supernatural truths in the Bible. That is, in the Bible, there are those truths which can only be known by God's revelation. But there are also truths in the Bible which are philosophically and rationally demonstrable. One of those being God's existence. To explain, God's revelation in the Bible is the ultimate standard of truth, and the authority of the church suffices to believe it. In addition, many of the truths in the Bible are supernatural, and that thus they go beyond our ability to prove or demonstrate. However, There are certain truths that the Bible teaches which can also be revealed and proved by reason. And if a revealed truth is also rationally demonstrable, then it belongs to the realm of natural theology. Now, I want you to notice the importance of this distinction. By asserting that certain revealed truths are also rationally and philosophically demonstrable, Aquinas effectively brings philosophy into the subject matter of theology under the auspices of natural theology. He was able to turn a philosophy, and again, that many, not all, but many still considered to be a threat, he turned it into an instrument in the hands of faith. So philosophy is now no longer a separate discipline. It now occupies its own place within the subject matter of theology. Now, one of the best examples or illustrations of how this natural theology is applied is the manner in which Aquinas deals with the existence of God. This manner has come to be known as Aquinas's five ways, and they function as five proofs for the existence of God. Let me make just one or two quick comments before we get to them. I want to give you the basic principle of these five ways, and then I want us to look at all five very briefly. Aquinas, he does not believe that the proposition God exists is a self-sufficient proposition. That is, it is not immediately self-evident to us that God exists. There was a man named Anselm, and he argued that God's essence, that is, who God, what God is, demanded existence. And thus he sought to prove God's existence, as we would say, ontologically. Basically, he was saying, if there is a God, the fact that we state God, his essence demands that he exists. And so therefore, God exists. This was not a technical argument. This was something that he wrote in Devotional Reflection, by the way. So if you're not impressed by that logic, keep in mind that he wasn't out to win a debate with that thought. He was just reflecting on the greatness of his God. But he said that God's essence demands that he exists. But Aquinas said this, God's essence is unknowable. We don't know what God's essence is like, and therefore you can't use his essence to prove his existence. But God as creator does have certain effects. And thus we can demonstrate God's existence by showing that there are effects of which God is the cause. These effects not only prove God's existence, but they also help us characterize him accurately. Not only can we know that he exists, we can know a thing or two about him, not exhaustively, but accurately. So here's the basic principle of Aquinas' five ways. The existence and design of the world is the most convincing argument of God's existence. It is an argument from the effect to the cause. Now, what are the five ways? Let me give them to you here. I've summarized each with a word to help you keep notes here. Number one, motion. So I'll give you the word and then we'll explain it. Number one, motion. The existence of a single original cause of all motion. Aquinas recognized that what goes on in the world is full of motion. Things are always moving. Things are always going on. Well, there must be some original cause that started all this motion in the first place. That original cause, Aquinas argues, is God. God is a being who is pure act. That is, in him, there is no potential. It's all action. Not potential, but action. Now, remember what we discussed about Aristotle's first unmoved mover. That he was a person, that is, the things that are active are the things that are the most real. The things that do not change are the things that are the most real. So thus, when Aquinas argues for the original cause of motion, he's being similar to this first unmoved mover. Here's the second argument. By the way, each of these are very similar because they operate from the same basic principle. Motion, secondly, cause. Cause. God is the first efficient cause of all other causes. And all efficient causes within the world, everything that happens in the world that causes something else, they are dependent on God's efficient causality. And that all the time. Or else they themselves cannot be causes. So again, if we see something in the world that causes something, it must have been caused by an original cause. That cause is God. So motion and cause. Thirdly, existence. Existence. God is a necessary being, Aquinas argues. Not like Anselm did, but a little differently. Here's what he means. All the beings in this world, you and me, are contingent beings. That is, we depend on something else for our existence. In Aristotle's work, he identified the heavenly bodies and the first unmoved mover as everlasting beings, and he called them gods. Aquinas, however, argued that these everlasting beings, such as the heavenly bodies, they did not have to be everlasting. After all, they might cease to exist. Because their essence, now follow this, because their essence, what they are, does not demand their existence, that is, that they are. What they are does not demand that they are. You can make a distinction, Aquinas is saying, between essence and existence. And Aquinas is saying, if you can make this distinction in beings, then there must be some being in which you cannot make that distinction. There must be some being whose essence demands his existence. Why? Because there are all these existing things. They must have some cause. They must be dependent on something that's not dependent on anything else. And that necessary being is God. And God is thus distinguished from his world by being self-existent and self-sufficient. Motion, cause, existence. Fourthly, perfection. God is the source of the limited perfections that we have in the world. For example, we have goodness in the world. We have truth in the world. Where do these come from? Well, God's perfections, they exist in creatures as limited perfections, yes. And thus they imperfectly reflect the divine being, but they reflect him nonetheless. So the fact that we have perfections in this world, they must have some source and some cause, and that is God. And then finally, design. Design. That is, God, he is not only the first cause, but he is the final cause, and he's the continuing source of the orderly motion of all things as they move and as they act. He says, look at the world and look at the regularity of the motion of all created things. That must require intelligence. And since many things which so move do not have intelligence, God must be the one who guides them. So the world shows obvious traces, Aquinas argued, of intelligent design. So five different ways, again, all very similar, all coming from the same basic principle, but five different ways, motion, cause, existence, perfection, and design, that demonstrate the reality of God. Here's the summary. God is not only the first cause of motion as a pure act, and the final cause of all things, but God is also the first efficient cause of all other causes, and the exemplar or the formal cause of all perfections. Furthermore, God is sheer existence. God is being in God's self. Now, when we come to the scriptures, we have presented to us a doctrine of creation, which describes a God who creates freely. And God can do so because divine life is fully and completely in him. We know that by divine revelation. But notice now, Aquinas claims by his five ways, we can also reach the very same understanding of God and thus come to understand God as one who is being of oneself, self-existent, and thus utterly complete. So the view of God as one who is absolutely independent and self-sufficient, whose life is full and complete in itself, a view which results from revelation, can also be reached by philosophy. And thus Aquinas has brought a synthesis of philosophy and theology in his teachings. Now, as we wrap that up, I want you to keep one thing in mind. I want you to remember the purpose of our study, which is to survey the role that philosophy has played in helping us understand theology. And as we have looked at Aquinas' five ways tonight, I want you to notice that I did not attempt to defend their truth or their validity. Aquinas, for example, has had his critics both in the Middle Ages and up to today. Notice how also we dealt with them in a survey manner. Didn't treat them exhaustively, nor Aristotle's philosophy. Such things would take more time than we have before us. But I do want you to notice this one thing. How Aquinas' five ways simply illustrate one more way in which the church's theologians have used philosophy to articulate or demonstrate Christian belief.